morning. We are absolutely setting a new precedence here this morning. Mark this date. I cannot believe each committee meeting, which had a lot of exceptional discussion, has gone quickly, and we are ahead of schedule. So, in that regard, I would like to welcome everyone to the Legislation, Audit, and External Affairs Committee. Sharon, would you please call the roll?
Butler?
Here.
Trustee Mambo Sanchez. Trustee Anthony Iasco. Trustee Robert Marshall.
He's here.
Student Trustee Robert Sorsby.
Here.
Chair Sherilyn Muir. Chair Sherilyn
Muir. Here, yes. Thank you.
Chair Mark Strauss.
Here.
Thank you.
Okay, good. Again, as we've all expressed our welcome to Mr. Blakemore, I, too, want to welcome you to the Legislation, Audit, and External Affairs Committee. And I have had the pleasure of speaking with Jerry, I told him, 3 days in a row. So that's a very good thing. We all look forward to working with you, and you certainly have hit the ground running, and we appreciate that very much. May I have a motion to approve the committee agenda as proposed?
So moved.
Second?
Second.
Discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Motion approved. May I have a motion to approve the minutes of the March 3rd, 2011 LAEA committee meeting?
So moved.
Second?
Second.
Bob did. Okay.
No.
All in favor?
Aye.
Motion carried.
Chair, a point of order here. As I walk along, I just want to make a point here that there are three Roberts in a row here. And I want to be sure it's understood that it's not a qualification to be on a board of trustees.
Yeah.
Robert Strauss, welcome.
Yeah. Well, as part of our reappointment, I did have to change my name to Roberta. So, but we do comply with the regulations of the state of Illinois.
If serves me correct, there's nothing in Robert's Rules of Order to describe that trustee.
Well, now okay. That's clarified, I think please proceed.
Thank you, Robert. Now we have Robert Montero and Robert Latham. Are they present today? AKA Jay and Todd. Do you have any comments? No, I wouldn't follow that act at all myself. All right. Well, you know, this certainly is a joyous occasion, isn't it, as we face a new graduation and spring, as the green is coming up. We have 3,500 graduates, and I would like to take a moment to recognize Robert, our student trustee. I think we should all give him a round of applause as he finishes this part of his journey. What are your plans after this summer?
This summer, I'll be starting work with Sears Holdings, but in the meantime, I'm going to try and pick up the game of golf.
All right. Well, I think president and Trustee Boy will help you at that.
I don't know about the helping part, but I saw him at the same driving range I was at last weekend.
Uh-huh. So this is great. You know, this is what we are about. We're a university, and it's our annual culmination of all of the positive things that happen in a university. To have new trustees, I'm so pleased that Mark and I were reappointed, and we're both here for another 6 years. But we are so pleased to welcome two new colleagues. And Bob, we welcome you. Tony Iasco is a friend of mine who went to law school with me. So we were students together. And now we're colleagues in the governance of the university that we both love so much. So those are all wonderful things that are happening. I would like to say that also we, in this committee, we deal with some very sensitive issues and very critical issues because we're dealing with issues of legislation which move us forward, audit, which is a reflection back, and our external affairs, which is our communication tool. So there are several things on our agenda today that we need to move quickly on, but with great sensitivity. However, before we do that, have there, Mr. Blakemore, have there been any timely requests to address this meeting?
No, there have not been, Madam Chairman.
All right. Thank you. One of the issues that is coming before us today is an issue that we have discussed over the last 2 years, and we have seen things ebb and flow. Things have modified because of changes in laws and regulations. But I want to say that we have been attentive to assure that we are moving, as President Peter says, beyond the 20th and 21st century, and to assure that everything we do at this university is timely and relevant to societal changes. Earlier this year, the General Assembly passed and the governor signed, as we know, the Civil Union Act, and that really did modify some of the discussions that we had in the past as it relates to needed modifications, and Trustee Butler has been at the forefront of bringing this to our attention, and that is much appreciated. Dr. Cunningham has been very attentive to these matters, and I think that you have some comments that you make, but this is an action item that will require a vote, and I think that perhaps we should hear Dr. Cunningham's comments, and then Mr. Blakemore, I think then we will I will ask for your comments regarding what is being proposed for a vote. All right?
Yes.
So, Dr. Cunningham, thank you.
Thank you. Good morning, Chair Muir, trustees. This is, as indicated at the last committee meeting, we would bring before you at this meeting recommendations regarding board regulations to implement the Civil Union Act, as is outlined in your board report on page 10. The governor signed Public Act 96-1513 into law on February 1. And that is titled the Illinois Religious Freedom Protection and Civil Union Act. And basically, the act provides that a party to a civil union shall be entitled to the same legal obligations, responsibilities, protections, and benefits afforded or recognized by the law of Illinois to spouses. And during our discussions regarding domestic partner policies at preceding committee meetings, we discussed even late last year the likelihood that the General Assembly would pass civil union legislation in Illinois, and that would have additional implications for our policy infrastructure. So the board reg item that is before you today really has in it three components. And we convened a committee of internal people, first of all, to look at our board regs and all of our policies throughout the university with respect to implications of the Civil Union Act. And that involved people from human resources, obviously, but from the legal services area, financial aid, student affairs, registration and records, housing, campus child care, admissions, and so on. So a very wide-ranging committee who assisted in making sure all of our policies will be updated in addition to the board regulations. And, of course, Vice President and General Counsel Jerry Blakemore assisted with this also. The board regs before you, we can just briefly go through them, are change tracked and incorporate necessary references to the Civil Union Statute in the three sections. Section 2 is faculty and administrative SPS employees. Section 3, very similar provisions for civil service employees. And then Section 4, provisions that relate to students. In addition to the civil union updates were made related to our equal employment and affirmative action statement. It was in need of updating. We did discuss that some at the last committee meeting as well. And minor additions to the family relationship provisions in addition to the civil union notation. We also updated that language to remove the words initial in those provisions pursuant to the recommendations of a university council subcommittee looking at these policies. So those things are included in the board regulations as well. So we've updated the family relationship provisions, the group insurance provisions. I might the comment that CMS has recently issued its implementing guidelines for the civil union statute, and in that respect, the group insurance program will continue to recognize domestic partner relationships that were certified into that program prior to the effective date of the Civil Union Act, June 1. But after that time, the CMS program will move to recognize civil unions instead. So that is how CMS has adjusted their policies.
And what is the date on that?
June 1 is the date on that. Then we also updated our benefit provisions, sick leave, incorporated a clause that would bring our provisions related to the Family and Medical Leave Act, also to incorporate civil unions, leaves of absence, educational benefits, which include tuition waivers for employees, deceased employees, and children, and as well as conditions of employment. Same thing in the civil service section. In the student section, we've updated all other necessary provisions related to student status, residency, and recognition of civil union as spouses. So those are combined in your materials today. I would just indicate that in our policy review, the university maintained all provisions that we've summarized in subsequent or preceding meetings related to domestic partners. Those are unchanged. Those are still in place. The role here, the goal was to incorporate the new civil union statute specifically as well.
Would you clarify one point that has been brought to our attention? That is the definition of natural parent. How does that relate to adoptees?
With respect to that, a parties to a civil union, if there was an adoptee for either party, that would be incorporated in the same manner for tuition waiver policies for children as would a natural child.
What does the term natural mean? I'm confused by that word. A natural parent, I don't understand.
I think that
is that biological?
Yeah.
Is that a word that we put in, the university put in? Is that something we should take out? Is it an area that would cause concern?
I don't believe so, but we can look into that, that was the preceding language with respect to the reference to
And
to
where
natural.
Did that language come from, Steve? Do you know?
The prior board regulations, I believe. But I'll check into that in time for our next meeting.
Okay. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Mr. Blakemore, would you like to make comments before I open it up to a motion?
I concur with the comments made by Vice President Cunningham. The only thing that I would add is, with respect to the specific language, the natural parent language, that was brought to my attention yesterday. The General Counsel's Office can take a look at that and come back to you with a proposal on that. My initial view of that is that it's probably not necessary, and it does have some confusing aspects to it. What we want to do is make sure that it's clear. The most significant issue with respect to this, from the General Counsel's perspective, is that we are required to be in compliance with a new law that comes into effect June 1st. That law provides equal benefits, obligations, responsibilities for those who choose civil unions along the same lines as those who choose what is more traditionally referred to as a marriage license. What we are doing here is making sure that the university is in compliance with that new act, and that's what is being proposed.
We will entertain discussion after a motion. So may I have a motion, please?
I'll move.
A second.
Am I on this committee?
Good question.
No.
Okay, so I'll vote. No, I won't.
You're not a natural.
All right, we have a motion, and Trustee Butler second.
I'm adopted.
All right, let me open this up for discussion now.
I guess it's a question to Mr. Blakemore. So what you're saying is at the end of this meeting, we have to have approved what is going to be in effect on June 1st.
As it relates to the civil union statute, yes. It's obviously up to the university to determine when, in effect, they would come into compliance with, you know, what is, in effect, a new state law. The proposal puts us into compliance with that specific law, and my recommendation is that we move forward on it to do that.
But, I mean, because I have certain things I'd like to see changed in here, and I think they're minor. So it's important that I get that out now, because what we pass today will essentially be what we present as our compliance if challenged after June 1st, because our next meeting is June 9th.
Right. The effect of this would be to have the full board, and correct me if I'm wrong on the process, the full board actually voting on the 9th before it becomes the force and effect of law of the university. So since we have a significant committee structure and process, the committee would take action, and it's basically a recommendation to the full board. There would be that time between then and now to make corrections. I don't want to overstate the significance of coming into compliance timely, because it's not as if the state – this is really an issue about our employees. You know, what types of benefits are we providing? And I would say we would want to do that sooner rather than later, and this would allow us to do that.
Okay. I have a few questions for Mr. Cunningham, Dr. Cunningham. You said that a committee of internal people, a wide-ranging committee, and the board documents talks about a protracted process that involved various offices. What's different between what that committee recommended and what's before this board?
The committee looked at both the board regs and also all of the various policies and programs we have in the university that could be affected by the civil union statute. And the committee also took account of the domestic partner provisions, because where civil union policies come into play are most of the places where domestic partner policies also come into play. So the committee looked at those and made sure that both references were made in those policies within the university. In terms of the board regs, the goal for this meeting was to implement the Civil Union Act, so those references are not also included in the board regs.
So, in fact, the committee recommended the use of the term domestic partner in addition to civil union for this committee?
The committee was charged, and I met with the committee at their initial meeting, and they were given the general request to look at all policies where these references are, and that they we would take account of all of their recommendations. And then, though, in terms of what was presented to the board today, that's up to the board committee. That wasn't up to the internal committee.
That's up to this board committee.
Right.
I think if I might try and put some parameters around this, I think that as the initial discussions began, what we had before us was the language of domestic partners. In when was this, March of this year, was the civil union, the passing of the civil union?
February, correct.
Right. So I think putting this in perspective, when we are talking about an evolution, the term domestic partner was always the only point that was in consideration, because we only had two choices, marriage or the term domestic partners. Only in March of this year did another terminology with its own connotation come to the forefront, and that was the passing of the Civil Union Act in the state of Illinois, which in that case changed, one, our need for compliance, because there was a state law that we needed to be compliant with, and that's what our general counsel has provided us regulations to be compliant with a new entity called a civil union that did not exist prior to March of this year. Now, that doesn't mean that the discussions that we had before were not critical, and it doesn't mean that there was, in fact, there was a change, but it was a change that was driven by the state of Illinois legislature. So what we have before us today is the discussion as to how Northern Illinois University Board of Trustees will deal with the issue of a new law that came into place in March of 2011, and that is to recognize civil unions in the same way that we're recognizing marriage. And then forthcoming is that ambiguity, that term that is more ambiguous because it doesn't come with it definition, is domestic partner. But what I think I heard both Dr. Cunningham and Mr. Blakemore say, and please reiterate, is that this language does not in any way impede what has been done for people in the past. Is that correct? So those that have and are receiving benefits as domestic partners will not be altered. Is that what you had indicated?
The practice of the university with respect to domestic partners does not change. And in fact, contrary to what the state is doing, which is cutting off those benefits, the university's practice is in effect. This is probably not the right technical word, grandfathered in, you know, for domestic partners. So you're absolutely right. So what we're doing now as a practice, it is not a policy, it is not, quite frankly, it's not regulated in terms of having regulation on it, but it is a practice that has been, from my understanding, from what I was briefed on, in place for some time. That will continue.
And just so that I'm clear, we have some employees currently that receive benefits as a result of being in a domestic partnership arrangement. Those will continue. Going forward from here, we're only going to recognize civil unions or marriages. Is that the way that the draft reads? Or are we continuing the concept of domestic partnership into the future as well?
It's my understanding that we're going to honor the practice going forward. For those who held that status before civil union, and for those who will hold that status without civil union going forward. It's just we're not defining it or codifying it in regs.
So if we had a new domestic partnership established after this regulation, it would receive the same benefit as a domestic partnership that exists today?
It's my understanding and expectation, we will continue that practice.
Correct.
Without the words domestic partnership.
The difficulty legally defining something and keeping our regulations clean and in comportment with state law and regulation. Because otherwise you get into situations of affidavits, and we don't want to do that across classes.
So what we have before us in a motion is the approval of these regulations to be compliant with the new legislation of March of this year relative to civil unions, so that the language of our regulations are modified to include the term civil unions and everything in that regard. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Okay, that's the motion. Trustee Strauss.
Thank you for indulging me. I'm suffering from the disability of not having been able to read this until I got here today, so I haven't been able to thoroughly study it. But there is one argument, which was that we had certain employees who were not able to put themselves in the same position as those who were married previously. And that was one of the strong arguments for why we ought to do something different. The civil union debate has changed that. Now, if we have domestic partners being recognized, how do you establish the domestic partnership? And what meaning is ascribed to that? I think that may be an item that we need to take a look at. Now, I'm not in a position to insist that we take a look at it today before advancing it to the board, because I believe that we have the time available to be able to try to sort through these things, and also that it's important for us to be able to demonstrate compliance with the civil union law. But I do think that that's a topic that we have to make sure that we've thought through thoroughly in a way that first doesn't take benefits away from people who came here with the expectation that they were going to be able to get them and have in fact been receiving them. But whether we then perpetuate that availability going forward is something that I believe we ought to explicitly consider.
Educate me. If there's a domestic partnership in existence, how does one change that into a civil union?
Well, the two people would have to overtly seek out a civil union
go to a court and change it into a civil union.
Yeah. I think for the sake of the discussion this morning, and I could not be more in sync with you, Trustee Strauss, I have had very high anxiety as it relates to how we define domestic partners. I really have a problem with that, trying to really understand what that means, how we define it, how we assure we don't have abuses. I think that the civil union, which is another step, which gives us a bit of breathing room, especially for non-heterosexuals, that is important for us to, as quickly as possible, assure that that is brought into practice and into compliance. The terminology of this domestic partner and the ambiguity of what that means, I think, needs to continue to be reviewed and discussed, at least for me, too. I don't feel 100% comfortable I understand that. So for this morning, I have a motion and a second in regards to the regulations as modified to include civil union to be compliant with state legislation in this regard, and this would be approved by this committee and then brought forth to the Board of Trustees. I will call a vote unless there's any more discussion.
I have considerable more questions.
Okay.
So can I get a clear answer to this question? Did the group that you assembled put forward a draft that included the word domestic partner? And that draft is not in front of us today.
A draft was prepared based upon the committee's feedback. And that draft, there were multiple drafts, including the changes to internal policies and procedures to incorporate civil unions. There was also a draft, in case it was needed, subject to the goals of this committee, that would also make references in board regulations. But that wasn't the charge of the committee. The charge of the committee was to look at all policies that could be implicated and to provide broad recommendations.
Could be implicated by the civil union legislation.
That's correct.
So that was the charge of the committee.
Right.
Was to incorporate civil union legislation into the board regulations.
That was our charge to bring before you today, yes.
Okay. Now, just a comment. I think we could have, as a board, considered that draft, and it would have allowed us to flush out some of these issues. I understand we have a timing issue, so let's move forward with this draft in particular. So, if I can just point out what I think is problematic, and would, in my opinion, it would be better if these were changed before the board voted on this in June. And I don't have many, so this won't take long if this is an appropriate time to do so. The first is on page 2, under number 7, subpoint B. Now, I would prefer that we actually spell out under B in the same way that we do under A what specifically we were talking about. But if the preference is to just simply say that the benefits shall be expanded, as it does here, can we simply add, after parties to a civil union, can we simply add, and children and parents of parties to a civil union?
Why don't we do this, John? Let's take your recommendations, and then we'll have an opinion by our counsel. All right, so we'll just hear what you have to say first, rather than responding.
Okay.
Okay?
And the reason for this is it could be interpreted that these benefits only extend to the illness or death of the party to a civil union, meaning just the partner, as opposed to their family. And this is a category that is devoted to family and medical leave. Under number 8 on the same page, I think we have the same problem. One, I think we need to put an A before party, because we have it in the other mention of bereavement leave. So it would read, include a party to a civil union, and I would like to see added, and his or her family members. Now, I'm not wedded to that particular language. It could be, and his or her immediate family or household, and relative outside the immediate family household, just as the language is prior to that. Because again, here, if we just simply list a party to a civil union, it appears as though this benefit is available only with respect to the partner.
Would you cite the section that you just referred to, please?
We're in section 2, D8. It's page 2, bottom of page 2 of our document.
What you're saying in the two instances is that you feel there's ambiguity that this benefit extends to the children of the two partners.
For the first one, but in with respect to bereavement leave, I think if we just simply leave it, shall include a party to a civil union, period, we leave the impression that it only is extended to the party to the civil union, meaning the partner.
And your suggested language again is?
A party to a civil union and his or her family members is my suggestion.
It may be just the placement of where the civil union is. If you had the placement of and parties to a civil union beforehand, where you then describe up to 3 days due to the death of a member of his or her immediate family. So if you take this clause and you move it up rather than down, it would be all-inclusive.
That's as well.
Okay. You see what I'm saying?
Yes, absolutely.
Jerry?
I see, and yes.
Okay. Anything else, John?
On page 4, we have different wording that could cause confusion. If we look, go back to page 1, if we look under family relationships, section 2.8, we see it says relationship by blood or marriage or civil union in accordance with, but on page 4, we have blood or marriage, comma, party to a civil union in accordance with. I simply ask that we use the same language on page 1, so it would say blood or marriage or civil union. Because here again you have a situation where if it says party to a civil union, it could be referring only to the partner. But in this particular case, it's just confusion.
Yes.
What about the definition that's there on page 4, the second paragraph of 5? This seems to define party to a civil union to mean and include spouse, family, immediate family, dependent, next of kin, or other terms that denote a spousal relationship. All I'm saying is I think I haven't had time to review this carefully, and some of this may be addressed through the definition, too.
Yeah, it might be just positioning.
I think we get the gist of your point. At least I do. Hopefully Jerry does. And maybe what has to happen is that we just need some time to reflect on making appropriate changes to make sure that there's no ambiguity about what what I guess I could call, for lack of a better term, a family unit constitutes for those who are engaged in a civil union.
I think I agree on that. I think maybe it's a placement issue, both in the clause as well as moving the definition in front so that there's consistency of the definition.
And I think that would be fine. Either you define it and say it's inclusive of spouse and family and what have you, and then you never touch it anywhere else, which I don't prefer. I think for the sake of ease of interpretation, because it's relatively new, because supervisors are going to be referring to it and thinking about it, we should spell it out. But as long as it's being spelled out in the current draft, we should spell it out in a way that will provide direction and guidance to those who are interpreting it. Now, the only other two instances of this are repeats of what I've already said. The one is also under family and medical leave, but now we're in section two, or three, and again under bereavement leave in section three, we have the same issue, And then the only other issue I have is the issue of the natural parent.
I agree.
Now, I don't know where the word natural parent comes from, but clearly it's it is used in these regulations, and it refers to a non-adoptive parent. So I don't know why it just doesn't say parent.
Well, I think that our general counsel has indicated that, and certainly whether it's biological or an adopted child, it is your child. So I think by the law, we understand that that we're not going to restrict it to biological. It would seem that that was just a misnomer. And if we just pull that out and talk about a parent is a parent, whether it's an adopted child or a biological child. So I think that could be dealt with. And I agree with you on that issue. All right. In this regard, I think that what we have here is it would appear that we have the intent. It seems, in terms of the language, Mr. Blakemore, it's a matter of moving things and clearly defining issues. The only other issue was that of the natural parent, taking that out to assure that we include adoptees. We could put a definition of parent that would explicitly talk about biological and adopted children. In this regard, what is the pleasure of this board, of this committee? We have a motion, and we have a second. Do we need a modification to this motion? If we do, we would have we have a motion on the floor. We'd have to vote on this, accept or deny, and then resubmit a motion, or are we comfortable that this is what is going to be taken to the board with the modifications in keeping with our discussion?
Just for the sake of discussion, would it be easier if I amended the motion to reflect that before it gets to the full board, that it would also incorporate the suggestions that were made today, and then there would be sort of an approval in concept subject to whatever reworking was done?
I think so. Would you do that?
Yes, then I will make that motion, and perhaps the seconder could also do so again.
John?
I would second that.
Okay. All right. Any further discussion?
Yeah, I just have a couple more. Just a quick comment. I think some of the difficulties that I had with the line-by-line content changes, and I want my fellow trustees to understand, I think that was the result of the extraction of the term domestic partner in what was prepared by the committee that Dr. Cunningham talked about. And the consequences of pulling that term out left the term civil union structured in such a way, sentence-wise, where it wasn't making the same sense that it was making. And so the reason I was asking those earlier questions was trying to get at the fact that at some point, somewhere, that term was pulled out before this got to the committee, and the result was a slightly messy and somewhat problematic set of edits to the board regulations, which had to be worked out. And the point I'm making is one of a process. I think the process that led to what we have in front of us could have been better. And that is despite the fact that I think that what we have here is very good. And I think that the work that the special committee that was put together did was very good. And I think up to this point, this discussion has been very good. And I think this is a real a major step forward for us, because this, even though we're doing this for compliance, this goes beyond compliance. We're being more thoughtful. We're being more careful. We're looking into areas, because of the formation of the special group, we're looking at areas that other colleges and universities are going to miss, and they're going to be challenged on those points. We're not going to be challenged because we did do this thoughtfully. So I want to thank those people, and I also want just the trustees to understand why I had to go through this.
I would like to make a response to your comment because I don't want to leave it as such. I have worked with Dr. Cunningham on this matter and with Vice President Bittner on this to great length. And I don't want to leave any insinuation that there was any deliberate maneuvering of removing words or replacing words. I want to remind this committee that we did have this discussion about civil union at the last committee meeting, which followed the passing of the legislation. And I, for one, felt quite relieved to have a definition because I continue to find it problematic to not have a definition, consistent application of a definition of domestic partner. So I think that the issue of the replacement, certainly my lead on that, I will take full responsibility in that I think that it was all our understanding that the state of Illinois assisted us with a very sensitive matter by landmark legislation, which is a very positive thing. So I don't want to leave any impression that a committee did a 360-degree turnaround. I think that the discussions prior to March related to domestic partner because that's what we had. I think post-March of this year, we had new legislation that clearly defined domestic partnership that was inclusive of non-heterosexuals, which was a very positive thing. And so I want to make sure that for the record, is also very clear. It wasn't just pulling something away. I think that what we have today is a motion that relates to compliance, but I agree the compliance is not necessarily legal in its entirety. It is substantive because I think it speaks to the philosophy of this university and this board, but we need to approve this, and any further discussion, which I think we should continue to have, then can enhance, embellish, change, modify, because this is a work in progress. So in light of that, we have a motion and a second. We have a modified motion. I will call for a vote. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Motion carried. Thank you. And I also want to thank everyone on this committee for really the respect that each one has had for the other point of view in a very complex matter. We'll move on to politics now. Certainly a tinge of sadness, but with wonderful best wishes, we are announcing this morning that this is the last meeting that Ken Zegner, and he's not even here today, Director of State and Local Relations, because he's doing his job, and he's in Springfield, but he has served us so well with such knowledge and such expertise and such political sensitivity in Springfield that his shoes will be hard to fill. But we wish him well, and he is retiring June 1st, so I hope he will receive the good wishes of this committee. Kathy, in that regard, because Ken's not here, can you give us an update on state legislation?
I'd be glad to, Madam Chair. Thank you. As of last evening, Ken and I were talking on the phone about what was happening in Springfield, and we've had some conversations about some rapidly developing legislation that appears to be taking shape that could run as early as tomorrow affecting public pensions. And basically, because of this, I've asked Steve, before I even get into this, it's so important to not only the university's bottom line, but also to each of our faculty and staff members, that I asked Steve if he would come forward and basically share this. Unfortunately, there is no bill that has actually been put out for public comment yet. So what we are hearing and what we are piecing together is the product of a lot of intelligence work on the ground from various sources. And we are told that the pension portion in terms of pension reform for the state pension systems could run as early as tomorrow in the House Personnel and Pensions Committee. So with that, I'd like to ask Steve if he would give us a brief update on what we are hearing at this point is contained within this legislation.
Thank you, Kathy. I'll be as brief as possible. I would, though, like to comment that the entire pension issue, the unfunded liabilities, the effect on benefits for our employees, the uncertainty about the future of those benefits, both for current employees and retirees, participants, is probably the single biggest issue affecting state finances and also the future status of our employees, our human capital investments, and so forth. The State University's retirement system, system-wide, and at Northern Illinois University, has had a 50% increase in retirement applications this year, based on averages in past years, because of both the fiscal and the policy uncertainty with respect to benefits coming out of Springfield. Now, this is driven by many factors, but the primary factor is, and I'm sure you all have heard this in the news, that Illinois leads the nation in terms of the scope of unfunded liability as a percentage of obligations for its pension systems. There's five major public pension systems. The CSRS is one of them. About 720,000 participants among all of those systems. CSRS has 212,000 participants. And there are two variables at work. One is the funding side, methodologies, proposals, actions to work on the funding model, to shore it up. The other side is the expense side, the benefits side, proposals, actions, possible statutes to affect the expense side. That would be to reduce benefits. There is a constitutional protection clause in the Illinois Constitution. It is very broadly written, protecting pension benefits for current participants, and that is at play as well. So all of these variables are involved with this. As Kathy indicated, there have been a number of proposals in the General Assembly discussed this session about reducing benefits. And the benefit issue, because if the funding side's not fixed, pressure goes on the benefit side. And the first step was taken last session to implement what we call Tier 2, which was a vastly reduced, defined benefit program for new employees hired on or after January 1, 2011. The CSRS system is a defined benefit system where there's a formula-driven retirement annuity calculation. CSRS also has a defined contribution option, which is called the self-managed plan, where employees can opt to pay that's why it's called defined contribution. You know your contribution, not necessarily the benefit. Very similar to a 401k or a 403b program. Now, both for teachers in the teachers' retirement system and university employees under the CSRS, these programs replace Social Security. So as we went into this session, Tier 2 had been implemented, but it only affected new participants going forward. So in terms of funding obligations, it had no effect on the massive population of employees and benefits that had already been accrued and continues to go forward. As Kathy indicated, the proposal that is gaining momentum in Springfield very rapidly would do the following. It would establish a defined contribution or a self-managed type plan for all of the public retirement systems. Right now, the proposal does exclude the judges' retirement system, but for all the other public retirement systems, teachers, state employees, and it's already in place for CSRS. It would then establish actuarially determined new employee contribution rates for three options, and would require participants to make an election as of a date in the future, perhaps July 1, 2012, to elect with the new contribution rates to participate in, to choose which option they wish to elect. For current employees, it would be those employed prior to January 1. They could elect to stay in Tier 1. The current contribution level for Tier 1 is 8%. Early actuarial proposals for CSRS indicated the new contribution rate would be upwards of 26%, taking account of both the normal costs, that's the cost to pay benefits every year, about 11%, and the unfunded liabilities, which are another 14 to 15%, the state's unfunded liabilities. The second option would be Tier 1, where the employee contribution would be much less, around 6%, 6.5%, and the third election would be the self-managed plan, where employees would continue to contribute what they are now, 7.5%. So the effect of this would be to put a lot of weight on employees to make this decision. We don't know what the final contribution rates are going to be. The policymakers are still looking at actuarial data that they are receiving from the pension systems. But in any event, this is going to create a great deal of uncertainty. And if there is significant migration of participants out of the current defined benefit programs, that will have the effect of only increasing unfunded liabilities, because these pension programs are designed to have a continuing stream of contributions made into the future. And when that's interrupted, as it has been with the state contributions in the past, it builds a wave of unfunded liabilities. And those currently require the state to pay 24-25% of payroll every year to fund the pension systems. And that's already not sustainable. So this bill, the pension directors oppose it because it would have the effect of only increasing unfunded liabilities in their estimation. It will probably go on a vehicle bill, Senate Bill 512, and as Kathy indicated, it could be in committee as rapidly as tomorrow for expedited action.
Cunningham. Did Mark?
No. Madam Chair, if I could just continue a little bit on the rest of the budget.
Yes.
I wish I had better news there. We'll start with our current FY 2011 appropriation. Basically, we're about 6 weeks out from the end of the fiscal year, and the university is still owed approximately $43 million by the state. We have received approximately 57-58% of our overall FY 11 appropriation with only 6 weeks left in the fiscal year. This is obviously, and you've heard the president say many times in the past, we don't have as much of a budget problem as we have a cash flow problem, because on paper we are legally entitled to the money. It's just not coming as quickly as it needs to be. And so it has created a significant cash flow issue around the campus this year, and the president's priority obviously is and remains meeting the $18 million monthly payroll. And we have been successful in doing that through a lot of management issues and things between Drs. Alden and Williams. So that's really where we stand as far as this point where we're at right now in the GR side, which is the general revenue side of the budget. In addition to that, and Ken is still down at Springfield, because of these issues, we have so many things going on. You just heard Steve talk about what could be coming as early as tomorrow in public pension reform. We've got issues involving employee health insurance plan and benefit choice options. We have employees in the Health Alliance program. Those of you who have read in the paper that the Quinn administration has chosen a different provider for that particular program for state employees, and it is proving very detrimental to many employees across the state who have Health Alliance physicians and things like that. So there's going the legislature is looking at this now to determine where this is going to set premium changes, health insurance premium changes, annuitant health care benefit changes. All of this is still in discussion format. There are no formal legislative proposals, but all of these things are literally under active discussion in Springfield. And obviously, our base budget discussion for the future for FY12 is framed around not only our base budget, as it always is, but also a new emphasis on performance-based funding and outcome measures, as well as trying to gain some relief from procurement reform, which is we've had quite a bit of discussion in this committee in the past about procurement. Right now, we sit with actual budget proposals formally introduced it on the table in the House and Senate of a 1% reduction in the House for the public universities for FY12 and a 3% reduction in the Senate for FY12. We are hearing as of last night that the Senate is moving that 3% to a 5% reduction. We do not have that codified into statute yet in terms of formal legislative initiatives that they will be pursuing. But obviously, the entire budget is being framed very differently this year than it has been in the past. And yesterday, I think, reality began to set in down in Springfield because the human services and the elementary and education, elementary and secondary education budgets, which make up about 53% to 54% of the entire state budget, were actually put on the table for a discussion as to where those cuts were going to take place. And I think, given the nature of democracy and the political dynamics within the General Assembly, the cuts that will need to be made in those programs are very, very deep. And so we will continue to have to watch closely where those cuts are going to have to be balanced out against the other portions of the state budget of which we fall in. So right now, you know, it's still early. We've got 3 weeks left. We're at 1% and 3%. All of this will have to be resolved in a conference committee at the end. We are being told that we are scheduled up to 5% now in the Senate for our FY12 cut, and we just don't know where it's going to go from there. So there is a lot going on and a lot for this committee. I want to just express my appreciation to the members of this committee who have been so willing in the past to, no matter what time of day or night I call on something, pick up the phone and reach out to their contacts in Springfield and assist us in convincing legislators of the importance of funding not only NIU but public universities in general and the good work that is done at these universities. So with that, I'll wrap up the General Assembly report. As far as the substantive report, you can read that in your book, your agenda materials, and I'm going to skip through the federal report because all of that is information as well.
Excuse me, I have a comment about the, as we conclude the state report. I don't think you were at the Finance Committee meeting, but I want to reiterate for this committee that I have asked our General Counsel to look at what remedies might we have if we do not receive full payment by the state as of July 1st, and that you would have those recommendations to us by the board meeting. All right. And I think that's important for you to know, Kathy, because we need to look at if there are any remedies we might have. Okay. All right. The congressional report is in our books, and are you going to move into the
We'll audit? Just move right to the audit findings.
All right,
yeah.
Fine. Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you very much. Any comments on the federal that you'd like to highlight?
No, I just, you know, things are obviously with no earmarks and things are shifting focus in in Washington as well, and Lori's back. But, you know, the bottom line is that there's no money there either. So everybody is kind of in a tightening mode everywhere we go. So.
All right. Thank you. Bob Albanez and Keith Jackson, I'd like to ask you to present to the committee the FY10 audit findings. I want to make note that there were no findings in either the government auditing standards or the financial audit, nor were any federal audit findings reported. Would you like to present the report? Thank you.
Good morning. Thank you, Board. We did have the five findings, and unfortunately, most of the findings are repeat findings, but they're findings that we've made significant progress towards. The first one is the required time reporting in the 15-minute increments that the state has required, and effective this last year, we have implemented an online facility to track that time that covers all the civil service and supportive staff. Hopefully, this will be the end of the audit finding for this particular item. So, the second was inadequate disaster contingency planning. This is kind of a follow-up finding with the university. We had told the state that we are waiting to implement new computer resources that we were going to put into service. We have done that. As we implement those new services, this finding should disappear. But the disaster contingency planning obviously is an ongoing issue. I mean, we have to make sure that we continue to move forward with that, and we are as a university. Inappropriate emergency purchases, this is one unique purchase that the university made. We disagreed with the state, with the Auditor General on this finding. There is a policy for all emergency purchases that the university followed. We turned in the information to the Procurement Board for their review. They are a separate standalone committee at the state level that has the ability to either approve or deny an emergency purchase request. Basically, it's approval unless they deny. They did not deny our request. The Auditor General took exception to the fact that this was for media services, and they made it into a finding. It'll never occur again because it was the implementation of a new media service plan at the university, but we still had to disagree with them because we have a system in place where there's checks and balances, and the Procurement Board didn't think it was wrong, yet the Auditor General made their comments, and we ended up with a disagreement on that one. The fourth one is weaknesses regarding security control of confidential information. This is a repeat finding. Again, this is more of an opinion-based finding than an actual finding. If you remember from last year, we had this finding for the first time where the auditors believed we could do better, yet they couldn't present any actual items where we had a violation of security policy. They just thought, maybe you should improve. We took exception to our philosophy that, because we do believe we have very good internal controls over disposal of confidential information. If you couldn't find an event that violated the policy, it's because there probably wasn't one. We don't like the fact that the OIG is becoming a little bit more opinionated in their findings, and we're taking a stance that, you know, if you find us violating a policy, we're going to fix it, we're going to agree with it, it's going to be straightforward. But in this case, there was, once again, no actual finding. It was their personal belief that we could be better. Now, we do believe that we are good with our findings or with our sharing of information with the university staff and everybody involved in the university as to the proper way of disposing of confidential information. And we continue to push those policies and the procedures to the staff so everyone is aware of those. The last one, computer security weaknesses. Unfortunately, we again disagreed with the OIG on this finding. They basically came out and said that we had an insufficient level of security. Our IT specialists disagreed. And if you need more detail, I'm going to have to defer to Wally on this one because it's well outside my realm of expertise.
Comments, questions?
On these last two audit findings, were they made with respect to other institutions as well, or to your knowledge, are we the only institution that got cited for these?
These are now system-wide. This seems to be the biggest topic at almost all the other universities. At least I know the top three universities, SIU, U of I, and ISU, had the same exact findings. And so it seems like they are trying to get everybody's attention to be focused on these issues. We at this university thought, though, that we shouldn't be grouped in with the other universities because we thought we had actually good policies in place and we had no actual evidence of failure to meet those requirements.
Do those other universities have the same auditor that was on ours?
One of them does. U of I does. Or we just ended our relationship with Clifton Gunderson. U of I has Clifton Gunderson still.
What would be involved in expanding the scope of the engagement next time around to maybe ask Clifton Gunderson what it would take to solve this so that we don't keep getting the finding?
That's a good question because technically we can't ask our audit firm to do that because...
Right, but they've rotated off now.
So right, now we could. We could come back and have that conversation with them to see if they believe there's an effective way to make this disappear. The issue really becomes one... In our finding, we're not technically, there's nothing that we've actually, they can show us that we violated. It's really more of an opinion. can we get past that hurdle where we have enough policy in place to change the Auditor General's mind that we're in compliance? That would be the benefit of having Clifton Gunderson come back and look at that. And we could open those discussions.
Yeah, I think that might be a way to address this to keep it from happening again. It seems that they are looking for a system of some sort. And I guess the only other comment that I'd have is that the inadequate disaster contingency planning sounds like a scary thing to a board member. And so this would be a topic that I'd like to see that we focus on to make sure that we have the ability to be able to clear it off.
Okay.
Especially since it's a repeat item, I think we couldn't contemplate all of the disasters that might befall us, but it would be good for us to make sure that we've done everything that we can in this area.
I think Wally would like to make a comment in response to your comment, Mark.
So on the disaster planning thing and why it's a continuing one, in the past it was the biggest complaint they had open against us was where we maintained our backup facilities, that it was too close to the center. We have, in fact, now fixed that, and that was the biggest complaint. The second complaint, which was a new one but tied under disaster planning, had to do with the elimination of the mainframe and having our whole disaster plan focused around that hardware product platform and how we recovered to the new distributed model we've implemented. Well, as we did all the changes, we intentionally just said, this plan's gone away, we're going to have to write a new one. So when the audit came in, we hadn't completed that. So the plan itself now has been documented. And that should go away. But again, under this thing, the last thing is testing. So we've continued to have this discussion with the auditors about what does testing entail. And they literally want us to take one of our major systems. Actually, they want us to take every one of our major systems and turn them off and then see what happens. Well, what happens is we'd have to restore files, we have to move things over, and we do this. We have a procedure how to do that. But the cost to do that to the university would be extensive because it's a manual hardware people, and you have to have a lot of people to do it. So I will say to you that the problems they identified that are fixable, we fix, and they're fixed every time. It remains continuing, and I think it will continue to be on our findings, immaterial and material, until we actually conduct a test of every major system annually. And I will prepare a budget for you on what I think that's going to cost us, but I can tell you that is the biggest financial burden we'd have, that it's expensive to do that. Does that make sense on that?
I understand what you're telling me.
Every year we fix everything they find except the one that is the testing one.
Yeah, I guess my personal experience, though, is I try to maintain backups of my own, but I know actually restoring the stuff is different than running the backup.
Oh.
And I think as much as it would cost possibly to solve this, it would cost even more if it failed and the restoration didn't occur successfully. So there may be some middle ground. Maybe we need to think more creatively about what it is that we can do to be able to approach satisfying the objection.
And we have restored our files. I mean, I want to go so you understand from a real perspective, we have, in fact, on almost every one of our systems gone to our backups, restored them, and taken up and not lost data. The problem is they would like to see us do that on a periodic basis with every major system. And that's difficult to plan for. I mean, you have to build a crew of people who do nothing but that. And that'd be, again, an additional expense. So it's not that we haven't restored files and done that. We have. And we've demonstrated that to them. And typically, on an annual basis, one of the systems does have that occur, either by natural disaster or program disaster. But we recover, and nobody knows about it. We document it. We show it. What they're saying is that isn't good enough. We want a periodic plan for every major system, and we want to see you do it. And that's the expensive part. So we will clean most of these up, and you should know that these aren't—they're not repeat findings, but it's an ongoing. It's covered under disaster. So every time we get a finding, we do fix it,
Thank you.
It looks continuous.
Thank you, Bob. You had a comment or a question?
I can remember.
We do have a different audit firm coming in this year, and that may change.
Oh, excuse me. A trustee boy had a question. Excuse me.
You are the
fourth
Robin on the right hand side.
Oh, God. No. Oh,
okay. One of us had to change names.
Trustee boy.
Thank you. Under the inappropriate emergency purchases, Give me an example of the university purchased media services as an emergency purchase. Give me an example of that.
I'll leave that one to Keith.
Specifically, we bought some, I believe it was TV Time with a media group.
Yeah.
This year, right before Thanksgiving holiday break, we went out there, put it on the emergency procurement board that we wanted to enter into this transaction within a week time period. The procurement board had 5 days to tell us yes or no, you know, and then we can proceed with that. They did not respond. We proceeded with that purchase of media services to do the advertising for the university. That was the one and only example of inappropriate purchases that they found us, you know, at fault on. They said purchase of advertising would never, in their mind, be an emergency. And we gave them the scenario where unless the state actually gave us money on a timely basis, we needed to advertise to get new students to continue to come to the university for a cash flow perspective. They didn't appreciate that argument.
Okay. Thank you.
Well, I mean, it's not an emergency if they react in 5 days, but it's an emergency if they react in 5 months. I mean, that's what you're really telling us.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. All right. Now, Bob Albanese. Yes.
We do have a new audit firm coming in, and it really there are three players in the process. It's the rep from the Auditor General, who has a reputation of being rigid in terms of audit findings. And Keith and this individual pretty much go at it from day one of the audit engagement. But the other player is that the audit firm has kind of recycled out, and our new firm is?
McGladrey & Pullen out of Schaumburg.
And therefore, they take a little different perspective. And that usually is a good thing because we get the opportunity to make our case with regard to some of the old findings, and therefore our hope is that we can kind of convince the new auditors to be on our side in defending some of these findings with the Auditor General rep.
Okay. Any other questions or comments? President Peters?
Yeah, let me put this in perspective. Overall, when you look at this audit, it is very thorough and very few findings relative to things we've been reading in the newspaper about other institutions, not to point fingers. And there are very few repeat findings. And so I want to commend everybody for doing that. The other thing that, you know, auditing groups come and go every 5 years, and the focus for public auditing changes depending upon what's happening in terms of accountability and some of the things that are reported. So you expect that. Now, I look down the road here, and I see a lot of experienced individuals who've sat on auditing committees. And now I have sat on a lot of auditing committees for NCAA, for Mid-America Conference, for the Fermi Lab, for the Fiesta Bowl. And I think basically I'm very pleased with what we do. But I think what you really have to do with auditing firms is listen to what they have to say and try to accommodate them as best as possible and not necessarily get defensive. We have nothing to get defensive about. You make your case, but also you hear what they have to say. There's no sense in creating a situation where none exists. This is really a good set of audit findings for us.
Thank you, Dr. Peters. Any other comments? I do have one comment, and that is, and I think I'm echoing Dr. Peters and Trustee Strauss's opinions. You know, it's very difficult to not be defensive, especially when you've been involved with the process for a period of time. But I think we either have different situations. One, we have the definitiveness of here it is, here's the regulation, were we meeting it, yes or no. If we're not, then we fix it. And I think what you've said, Dr. Peters, in most cases that's been fine. What disturbs me is the discussion relative to opinion with no backup on findings. And I would look to our general counsel again to see, are there any due process opportunities, if not formally, perhaps informally, especially, and I think Trustee Strauss indicated that, where multiple universities may be having the same issue. It's very important that if there's a regulation, we follow it and we do it. but it is not based on opinion. It's based on what the law is.
The informal process is going to be the only one that's going to be close to success. You don't have any formal processes other than sort of the appeals that you typically have. This really becomes an issue in terms of the competence of the auditors. And unfortunately, we don't hire them. We pay, but we don't hire them. And it's just the structure that we have at the state. So that informal process of letting people know, even though it is after the fact, obviously, is helpful in the long run, but there are no legal protections for us. It's literally going to be formal, informal.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much. Thank you for a good job. Thank you. Okay. All right. We have ending on a very positive and enthusiastic note. We're going to talk about the Blackboard mobile smartphone application for NIU students. We talked about this at the last meeting, and it is pretty exciting technology. We have the Director of Web Communications, Janice O'Brien, and I think you have a little show and tell for us, right?
I do. I have a tour.
Okay.
Thank you. Good morning. NIU's new mobile app will be available in app stores next month. It's for every major smartphone platform, and the one that I'm going to show you a preview of today is for Apple devices, so the iPhone, iPod Touch, and iPad. The first app is the directory, and this is based on the directory from the NIU website. It has a really nice, simple interface. You just plug in first name and last name, and it calls up the person's contact information. The nice thing about it is then you can initiate an email to that person right from within the app. The next app is Athletics. Each team is represented on the first page. Once you pick a team, you can see news related to that sport, their scores, and their schedule. Our events app pulls data from the all events calendar on the website. We have 10 categories, or you can search across all of the information. Once you find the event that you want to learn more information about, it will show you where it is, when it is, and it gives you the option to add it to your calendar on your smartphone. The courses app is the information from our course catalog, and it's updated daily, so it's always very current. Users can see the course section, the time, the location, and a description. They can also bookmark a course for future reference. The Maps app lets you look up any building on campus, and then it will tell you the address, a little description of the building, and whether or not there is Wi-Fi in the building. It also has a picture. For phase two, we're going to incorporate a list of departments and offices in each building and hyperlinks to their websites. We have a videos app that's directly tied to our YouTube channel. It shows you the latest videos that we've posted on YouTube, but you can search through any of ours. Once you pull up the detail on a video, it will give you a description, and you have the option to watch it right there on your device. Our news app is linked to NIU Today. It incorporates all of the latest stories. Once you select a story, you can read it in its entirety, and then you also have the option to email it to a friend and share it over a variety of social network outlets. The Images app is tied to our Flickr account, and we have a few categories that we thought were of interest to mobile phone users. You can save any of these photos down to your smartphone and use it as your wallpaper. Mobile Learn gives students and faculty access to what they traditionally access through our NIU website. It's the academic part of Blackboard. So they can look up course information, take part in discussions, view announcements. Our emergency page right now is emergency numbers, campus police, late night ride service. In phase two, we hope to be able to implement the ability to sign up for text messages and email advisories. The library app allows users to search the library catalog. You can see where a particular material is located and if it's available. For phase two, we're going to be adding three new components, places, tours, and transit. Places lets us add merchants on campus, so we'll be able to highlight dining halls and their menus, different businesses that accept Husky Bucks. For tours, we'll be able to program in guided tours, and also people will be able to identify what location they're at on campus, and it will show you the quickest route to get to wherever you want to go. Transit will incorporate our Husky Bus Tracker from our website, so you'll be able to get real-time information on where the buses are and also look up schedules. And that concludes the tour portion. Does anybody have questions?
Any questions? I think this is just super. This is just fantastic. And, you know, we have such a talented staff. Thank you for what you've done on the web. Wally, your staff in IT is absolutely remarkable. And Kathy, what you've been able to do in marketing. And what really is remarkable is bringing this all in-house. And it's my understanding we really have farmed out very little. Is that correct?
That's right.
In terms of media and marketing and tech and IT? This is being done in-house, and it appears to be beyond state-of-the-art. So this is terrific. These things, all these apps, do they cost anything to the student?
No, totally
okay.
Free to download.
Tell us again about that, because that's important.
They're completely free. Anybody can download them, and they'll be available in all of the app stores.
And when will this be available?
Next month. We're going to do a soft rollout this summer.
Good.
So we can test them out, and then we're going to promote them heavily in the fall when the students come back to campus.
And from a competitive standpoint, how does this technology compare with our competitors, our other state universities or private universities?
I think students expect it, and there are other universities that have this. I think we've made really good use of it. You get out of it what you put into it,
yeah.
And you can take it out of the box and set it up that way. We've gone through the trouble of identifying exactly what information should be in there and branding it as NIU.
Great.
Well, so I think it's a good product.
Good job by everyone. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Oh, okay.
We have something else. Okay.
Kathy wanted me to show you one more thing. This new website went up last night. It's our rankings and recognition website. This is new information that we solicited from all of the deans. It highlights rankings and then points of pride types of material from each college. Each college has its own page as well as outreach. The information is going to start to be featured heavily on the NIU website. Just today we've popped up some ranking seals, which you'll see on high-profile pages, and then we'll be working with each college to include a link to this information from their websites.
This is terrific. Great. I mean, communicating is the way that we market, mm-hmm. and marketing is the way that we enhance our student population. So this is the essence of what we do. Good job. Thank you. Any other comments? Thank you. All right. Are there any other matters to come before this committee today? If not, our next meeting is August 25th at 11 a.m. I need a motion to adjourn. A second? Yeah. We're adjourned. Thank you.
Let me just say that there is lunch out here for anybody who would like to gather and eat. It's available. We're a little off schedule today, so...